Welcome back to another exciting episode of Monty and Rias versus Movies. I'm Monty.
I'm Rias.
I apologize for the staid, boring introduction, but we've just done two really exciting introductions and the audio wasn't working.
So we thought that if we did a boring one, the audio is more likely to work. And hopefully we will wake you up with our exciting commentary on great modern films.
We watched a great modern... Did we watch a great modern film?
No.
We watched...
All right, go back to sleep.
We watched a very modern film. That's what I'll say.
Too modern.
You want to get into it or you want to talk about other stuff first?
Well, I was using the great modern film as a segue into the movie we watched from 1929 because I thought that would be funny.
The problem is the movie we watched from 1929 wasn't modern or great.
Yes, it was supposed to be a joke.
Oh, I get jokes.
Sure you do.
We watched Hollywood Review, also called Hollywood Review of 1929.
Now, what's interesting about Hollywood Review of 1929 is, as you know, we recently saw and disagreed on the movie Babylon.
Babylon!
Which I'm coming around on. I want to see it again, but it is gone from every theater.
Because it bombed so hard.
Like a ghost fart.
They spent so much money and time on that movie and nobody wanted to see it.
But now I want to see it again and I don't have the option and it's very sad.
It'll be on streaming soon.
Or it'll come to the Dollar Theater.
So Hollywood Review of 1929 is in one of my favorite genres of movie, which is very, very early talkies, before they had any idea what they were doing. I love these movies so much. They usually just... fill out the runtime with vaudeville.
Well, yeah. So what the deal with Hollywood 1929 review of, that's what it's called.
Yep.
That's what it's called now.
You got all the words
is
in there.
Is that the production company, I think it was MGM for this one.
Very MGM, yes.
Very MGM, wanted to introduce people to their new and exciting sound technology.
And who wouldn't, right? So...
they got all the actors they had. Everybody that had a minute came in and recorded a number.
Now, if you are listening to this far from 1929, as it seems like you probably are, you might not recognize some of the names. For instance, the name Marie Dressler is why we watched it, because...
I have the television just set up to record anything with Marie Dressler in it. She is amazing.
Marie Dressler was a comedian... A dowager type.
She was a vaudeville star. She was a Broadway star. She was active in starting the first union on Broadway.
She was the biggest star in Hollywood in like 1930.
Yeah.
Bigger than Garbo. Garbo would not come do this movie.
No.
But Marie Dressler did, and she's great.
Right.
Also, the cast contains John Gilbert and Norma Shearer. It contains...
everybody that was anybody that was on the MGM lot. Marion Davies.
Okay, so I have a book called, hang on, I'm going to get it correctly, A Song in the Dark. And this is a book about the very, very early musicals, like Footlight Parade. You ever seen Footlight Parade? I'm asking the audience, not Rias. Of course she's seen it.
Of course I've seen it.
Footlight Parade is a movie about what happened when... movies started replacing vaudeville, so they had to put in stage acts between right. the movies, and they were put on by James Cagney.
Right. It stars James Cagney. He is a guy whose job is to go into movie theaters and say, look, before you have the movie, you're going to have some kind of pre-show to get people interested. I guess possibly because at the time, movies weren't very long. So he goes in the theater and he sets up a pre-show. And the best part about Footlight Parade is that these pre-shows are choreographed by Busby Berkeley.
Busby Berkeley!
So they are gigantic production numbers that there is no way they would ever fit in a movie theater, even a movie palace of the day.
They wouldn't fit in anything. There's water numbers.
There's mermaids. There's fireworks and explosions. It is a fantastic movie. Very much a product of people wanting escapism during the Depression.
But I think this is the movie that also has people coming into audition with vaudeville acts, like the guy who has a number of amusing sneezes.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that's in this movie, but I know the guy you mean.
It might be in Broadway Melody. The problem is, dear listener, these movies don't have plots. So they could just have anything. And I love vaudeville. And these are well-filmed actual vaudeville numbers, which I, for one, am excited by, even if they are not, strictly speaking, good or entertaining. So, Hollywood Review of 19...
I saw a movie once with Moms Mabley in it when she was like 17.
Nice.
Okay.
Was she doing the act already?
Yes.
Nice.
Fantastic.
So, Hollywood Review of 1929 has some of the following people. Jack Benny. 1929 Jack Benny. He's like 35. He isn't even doing the joke about how he's only 39 yet.
No, he hasn't gotten there.
It's got Laurel and Hardy, who were at the time vaudeville stars and silent film stars. This was their first sound recording.
And it's weird because they're kind of off-center the whole time. Like sometimes Oliver's not even, is barely on screen if he steps aside. And that's because they were framing it so that they could have the sound running up the side of the film stock.
Yeah.
Because they had not done that before.
And that's the only good print we have.
And the only print we have is this one existing one that DCM was kind enough to show us in the dead of night.
But the book A Shot in the Dark has information on the production of Hollywood Review of 1929. Marion Davies had to shoot her number from 6:45 p.m. to 6 a.m. because she was shooting another movie during the day. Laurel and Hardy were called in and told, you got a couple hours, put together something. And I'll tell you, it's great.
Yeah. They knew their roles. They knew how to put an act together. They had been doing it for a long time.
Oliver Hardy's hand gestures are so persnickety and so precise. I just loved that
piece. They're hilarious. The premise is that they're stage magicians.
Yeah. But Laurel and Hardy are stage magicians.
That's all you need to know.
This number contains a banana peel gag. Not done ironically, just straight up, here's a banana. Oh, we can't do the act. I'll just throw the peel here. Later, here I am with a cake. Oh no, there's a banana peel. Slip, bump.
It's probably not the first banana peel gag. I believe the banana peel gag probably dates to silent films.
Oh yeah, absolutely it does. But
or cave paintings.
It's really fun to see it in the wild like that. There's also Joan Crawford doing a dance that's in That's Entertainment.
Right. And, you know, before Joan Crawford was known for adopting and abusing her children, she was also a big old tramp in the 1920s. She slept with everyone to get a job. And that's why that's why she had to adopt those children later, was because of so many abortions.
I feel like there was some of Joan Crawford in Margot Robbie in Babylon.
There is.
There's also...
She's kind of an amalgamation of all of those actresses.
Yeah. And there's also a Buster Keaton number or two, and those are pretty bad, unfortunately.
Mm.
This isn't the movie that introduced the song Singin' in the Rain, but this is the movie that made Singin' in the Rain big.
Right. Singin' in the Rain's been around for a while.
Yeah. And this is the movie that, according to the movie Singin' in the Rain, John Gilbert lost his career over.
Right. Because there are a lot of rumors around John Gilbert's performance in this film. One rumor was that people hated him because his voice sounded squeaky. The other rumor that I've heard is that the reason his voice sounded squeaky is because the studio execs were mad at him, and so they recorded the sound on the wrong speed, kind of like the Chipmunks. But the truth is, he sounds fine in this film.
Yeah, it's a Romeo and Juliet number with Norma Shearer. The first time through, it's kind of dull. Then Lionel Barrymore, who is directing them for some reason and is uncredited for some reason, says, do it a little more jazzy. And then they do a bunch of jazzy slang and end with Pig Latin. It's fine. It's, you know.
It's charming. And it's weird seeing a young Lionel Barrymore.
It is very weird seeing a young Lionel Barrymore.
I have got to show you this movie South of Zanzibar sometime, or East. Maybe it's west. Well, it's,
now listen. It's, hold on.
It's some direction from Zanzibar. It is a Todd Browning film, and Lionel Barrymore is very young and plays the bad guy.
Okay. I'm in.
Great film. Silent, but so, so good and so messed up. You would never have gotten this film past the Hayes office. No, you would not.
All right. Let's see. Ukulele Ike is all over this movie. His real name was Cliff Edwards. He's the voice of Jiminy Cricket.
Oh, I didn't know he was the voice of Jiminy Cricket.
The old voice, not, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
No, no, the old cricket. The cricket we grew up loving.
I liked Ukulele Ike. I thought he was pleasant.
He had some, yeah, he was. The first number in the film, however, is just a full-on minstrel show number.
Yes.
And they try to switch it up by like, ooh, half of the dancers aren't blackface and half of the dancers aren't. But look, we can switch the film to negative and it switches which side the blackface is on. And it's...
I mean, look.
It's an artifact of its time.
It's 1929. Minstrelsy is the dominant art form of the nation, I think.
I don't think it's ever been the dominant art form of the nation, but...
I mean, there's all these songs, like, they come out and they sing, Old Folks at Home, Old Black Joe.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the Swanee River.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as bad as some movies from this era, but it isn't great.
No, it's not great, but it's there. You should know about it before you go in.
Yep.
It's just the first number in the movie. Meh.
This, I would say Hollywood Review of 1929 is not for everyone, but especially after just having seen Babylon, it was very much for me. I loved it.
Right, because Brad Pitt is basically playing John Gilbert.
Pretty much, yeah.
Because Brad Pitt in the movie, in Babylon, gets laughed off stage because he has this dialogue where he says, I love you, I love you, I love you. And he says it like 9 times and the audience starts laughing, and that's kind of what kills his film career. And that is actually something that John Gilbert did in a film, was the same I love you speech.
His Glorious Night.
It was also called His Glorious Night, and it was directed by Lionel Barrymore.
Weird.
He should have known better.
So I want to see His Glorious Night and see if his voice is squeaky.
It's not.
Of course it isn't.
But I will bring it. I will get you that movie sometime. We can watch it.
The thing is, he kept acting after 1929. He's co-stars in Queen Christina with Greta Garbo in 1933.
Well, yeah, but that's because Garbo would only work with him.
Well, that's very nice.
And forced the studio to put him in it. They did not want him.
Too bad for them then, I guess.
Yeah, he's really good in it. Except that she's a lesbian. I mean,
what?
The character, Queen Christina, there's also a character in the film that is her best friend and lady-in-waiting, and in real life, that was her girlfriend.
Gosh.
I sure know a lot.
You do sure know a lot. So that's, I guess, what we have to say about Hollywood Review of 1929. Also recently, I watched Electric Boogaloo, the wild and told story of Ken in films.
That's fun. I did not watch it with him, but I've watched it before. The best thing about Electric Boogaloo is that it gives you a great overview of all the canon films, and you can make a list of the ones that look particularly interesting.
Which is why I watched Life Force, which...
Life Force is interesting. Life Force is the... I think it is one of the high points in latex practical effects. There is a dead body in there that looks just like an inflatable balloon. It's fascinating.
It's also, the script was written by Dan O'Banion, who wrote Alien and Dark Star. And wouldn't you know, it starts off with a spaceship with a monster on it.
He does like monsters in space.
He likes monsters in space. And who else? Yeah, who doesn't
like a good space monster?
Yeah. You watch anything interesting recently?
Let's see. What have I watched lately?
That's a rhetorical question. We use the same television most of the time.
I watched a movie called Catherine called Birdie, which I really liked. It's a kids movie. It's great for like a 12 to 14-year-old audience. Very cute, set in the Middle Ages, about a young girl who is very high-spirited, and her father's trying to marry her off to various guys she doesn't like.
Okay.
It's very sweet. It's got a really good cast. Billy Piper's in it. That girl that's in The Last of Us that was so good
in
Game of Thrones is in it.
Bella Ramsey.
Bella Ramsey plays the lead, and she's great. Maybe not for everyone, but for an afternoon when you're kind of feeling low and you want something that's harmless and going to be nice to you, that's a good choice. It is a friendly movie where nothing too terrible happens to anyone. Yay!
Yay!
Also watched something called The Most Assassinated Woman in the World. And that's like a murder mystery type thing set in the Grand Guignol Theater in Paris. I mostly watched it because I am fascinated by Grand Guignol Theater.
Sure. Garish as heck, just like the movies you like.
I've even seen some of the original scripts from the Grand Guignol produced on stage, and they are a lot of fun.
Nice.
So I watched that. It was okay. It just didn't completely come together as a story. That happens.
It does happen.
It was good. It was good to look at. The performances were good. It had some cool special effects that they were performing on stage. But overall, meh. And let's see. Oh, and we just got back from seeing a movie.
The title of this episode of Monty and Reyes versus the Movies, Missing.
Missing. Now, Missing is kind of a sequel to a movie called Searching that came out a few years ago.
Yeah.
It starred John Cho, which was, I think, why I ended up watching Searching, was because I like John Cho. And the whole movie is basically takes place on a computer screen. In Searching, a guy's daughter disappears, and he's going through her, and he figures out how to get onto her social media and find out what her actual life is about. It felt pretty invasive to me if I were the teenage girl, but at the end of the movie, he does end up getting her back, so hooray, I guess.
Yeah, in Missing, the inciting incident is that you've got June, who is a girl who's a real, real jerk to her mother.
She's a teenager.
And her mother goes off to Columbia with some guy and is missing.
Yeah. She goes to pick her mom up at the airport. Nobody shows up. So she gets on her social media and she starts investigating her mom's boyfriend that she went to Columbia with. And they find out he's got weird, dark secrets. And then her mom has some weird secrets. And I don't want to spoil it too much.
Yeah. Like, you get the idea.
It's one of those movies that wants you to think one thing for a while, and just when you decide, oh, that's what happened. No, but something else comes up.
Yeah, and I think that aspect of it was done very competently.
It was.
Like, this is a movie that understands technology, which is pretty rare. Like, it's not using Bookface or something. It's not even using Facebook, because June is a girl in 2023.
If she was a girl in 1923, she definitely would not be using Facebook.
Right. Okay. So she's on TikTok. She's on those chat apps, you know. And, you know,
Those things the kids today are into.
When she starts digging into things, it's pretty plausible how she gets passwords and how she gets around. Like, that aspect of it, that was plausible, and the storyline where she's investigating one thing and then investigating another, it worked for me.
Yeah. The problem was that we are on our computers a lot. One of us is on a computer right this minute.
I'm looking at my waveform. Oh, look at that waveform. Oh, that's a pretty waveform. I'm engineering the podcast. The thing is, we went to a movie theater, right? A dark room with these reclining seats and a giant screen. And the movie is from the point of view of June's laptop.
So every time you see June, you're seeing her from a webcam or later via a security camera.
And a lot of the time, you're not even seeing her. You're just seeing a zoom in on a mouse cursor where it, like, am I going to press this button? No, I'm going to go over here. I'm going to press this button. Click. It's pretty oppressive, and it's not pretty to look at.
No, it's definitely a movie that I feel, because I watched the first one like on a TV and it was fine, but I feel like being in a movie theater with a giant computer screen after a week of looking at a computer screen for work was a little much for me.
I found the movie ugly to look at, even while I admired how it did visually storytelling well. But I want a movie with cinematography. I kept thinking, you know, last year or
last week we went and saw Avatar, which had arguably too much cinematography.
Yeah, last week I was in a giant alien world and I saw sights I'd never imagined. And here I'm seeing somebody's Twitter feed. I can see that from my computer, although I'm not on Twitter right now. I didn't find as movie fun to look at. There was one character that was my favorite. I think he was my favorite because he got to wander around in Colombia.
Right. Her mom is missing in Colombia, so she gets on whatever the Colombia
Task Ninja is what Task this calls Ninja. It. I don't know if that's real.
Yeah. She gets on the basically task rabbit, finds a guy that for $8 will run an errand for her in Colombia, hires him, tells him about the missing mom, and then he goes and does all her legwork for her, and he's great.
Yeah, like...
He's a really interesting character. He's a nice guy. He sympathizes with her.
Yeah, I loved him.
Yeah.
And I do think part of the reason I loved him is that I could see him in Colombia.
Right. We were seeing his footage from his cell phone of Colombia, but we were still, at least it was not that house that that girl's in looking for her mom on the internet.
Yeah. But, you know, it's...
I didn't hate it.
I think if you're watching it at home, it's going to be an acceptable thriller. Like, I was certainly tense during a lot of it.
Yeah. There was a lot of times that I was like, oh, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
And also, I listen to a lot of weird podcasts about internet con men. I'm totally into the internet con man genre of podcast. I'll admit it.
Admit it.
I admit it. And podcasts about people who are in bad relationships. And so a lot of this film was like, oh, yeah, this guy clearly watches the same listens to the same podcasts I do.
And that's good because, like, there's podcasts in the world of the movie, and they sound plausible.
Yeah, sure. There's a true crime show that they watch.
Yeah.
Some kind of Sick Sad World equivalent.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought this was okay as a movie, I guess. I'll probably give it like 3.5 out of 5 stars.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fine. I mean, it was an entertaining way to spend the evening. The theater has pretty comfortable seats.
Yeah.
They will bring food to your seat in this theater, but it's not like an Alamo Drafthouse situation. It's like, here's your popcorn, loser.
Yeah. And I say, thank you. I actually want to go back to the television segment really quick, because it seems to me that there's two big television shows we didn't mention. And since they're a major subject of conversation around the house, we could have that conversation on mic.
Oh, well, what shows are they?
Number one, The Legend of Vox Machina.
Oh,
we watched The Legend of Vox Machina, season 2, episodes 1 through 3.
Yeah, the story moves a lot faster than it does in the game.
It really does. It
really does.
Yeah, like...
I am surprised how far we have gone in 3 episodes.
And yeah.
I don't want to spoil anything, but if you haven't watched season 1, you probably should, because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, season 1 is very good. It does start off with, I feel... a little too much edginess in the first couple episodes where they're like,
yeah, it's a lot of
here we go. There's going to be cursing and body parts and stuff.
Yeah, I kind of hate when they do that. And they do that a lot in the first season. It's like, calm down, edgelords.
Yeah, but once the first couple episodes are out, then they do calm down and it's good. And season 2 is here and it's good.
Yeah, liked it a lot.
Another TV show we watch is RuPaul's Drag Race.
Ooh.
So here's the thing about RuPaul's Drag Race. It's on MTV now, and that means the episodes, for some reason, are now 1 hour instead of 1.5 hours.
And you can tell they are cut to hell.
Especially because this season they have 16 people. Way
right,
more.
You can't get through 16 people in 1 hour.
This was episode 3, and they had Snatch Game.
They had 2 separate Snatch Games.
Because you can't have a single Snatch Game with 14 people. That would be crazy. If you don't watch RuPaul's Drag Race, Snatch Game is the match game. You know, from the 1970s?
Which was way before anyone except RuPaul, who is on that show, was born.
Yeah, there are some absolute twinks.
And these children don't really seem to know what match game is, but they do dress up like celebrities and impersonate them and give funny answers to dumb questions.
Yeah, everybody...
And they fail so badly sometimes. It's really embarrassing.
Everybody on the show seems to think that the number one thing you have to do in Snatch Game is look perfect, like the character. Number 2, talk perfect. Number 3, banter. That is wrong. Number 1, banter.
Yep.
If you say you're going to be Joan Rivers, that means you are guaranteeing me. You're looking me in the eye and saying you're going to have jokes on jokes on jokes on jokes.
Yes.
And I don't care what you sound
like. You're going to say a lot of stuff about your husband until he dies, and then you'll feel bad.
And as it happens, that is what happened.
Yep.
Like, somebody did... Joan Rivers had a good Joan Rivers voice and excellent Joan Rivers jokes and won.
Someone should do Phyllis Diller on Match Game.
Someone has done
Phyllis
Diller.
That would be a good character.
I'm certain someone's done Phyllis Diller.
I hope someone has. She's such an icon.
She is. But anyway, there were 14 people in Snatch Game, and it's just way too rushed.
Yeah, you get like half a line from each of them. You don't really get a feel for what their performance was. Even the cast are on Twitter talking about how, wow, they really made me look good in the Match Game cut. And I'm like, that's somebody who was at the bottom of the challenge.
Yeah.
I want to know how bad they actually were.
Like Sasha Colby, a drag legend, I am told.
A drag legend.
Had one line. That's not. That's just not enough. Oh, Ginger Minge was on Snatch Game of Love. You remember that?
No, but I'll believe you.
Okay.
Why would you lie to me about something like that?
Why would I lie to you about something like that?
Oh my God, are you gaslighting me from the other end of the couch, you
no,
monster?
I'm trying to gaslight the listener and you're not making it very easy.
Well, I was trying to segue into a joke about 1929 and you didn't make that easy either.
So anyway, I just wanted to say that the episodes are too short. I really liked Untucked this week because Sugar and Spice stopped being Sugar and Spice and started being People, which was very sweet, although they did it because they knew one of them was going to be going home.
Yeah, I kind of...
Bias
they're
hates
not,
them.
I don't hate them.
Drag
I think
them!
I'm not gonna, because they're actual human beings, but their style of drag does not appeal to me as much as others.
They're so cute, though.
That's what I mean.
I know, you like ugly drag.
Hey.
You do like ugly drag.
I grew up on John Waters films.
Yeah.
Leave me alone. I do like ugly drag. It's true. I like monsters. I like crazy tentacle drag.
Yeah.
I think that for someone trying to look like a human woman isn't far enough. That's not enough.
Well,
push it further. Look like something else completely.
Sugar and Spice weren't looking like humans, but they went the other direction from what you want. They were looking like Monster High dolls.
They looked like Monster High dolls.
So what else you got?
Do you ever see the spine on a Monster High doll? They have terrible posture. They're all bent and weird looking.
Is that what that doll in the
doll
area is?
Yeah, the headless doll.
Yeah.
That's a Monster High doll, and she's not anatomically feasible. She's got a bad sway back.
Well, it's a Rob Liefeld doll then.
The waist is too big.
All right.
So anyway, they look like a Monster High doll.
Yeah, and Rias just does not approve of them. I like them.
I don't approve of their we get everything we want because we're cute.
I don't
is
think
how
they,
I felt about them.
I don't think they do get everything they want because
I know,
they're cute.
That's just how I feel.
I know.
It's because I've never been the cute one.
Oh, Rias.
So sad.
Oh, it's so sad. It's so tragic.
Ballerina Barbie.
Malibu Barbie. Okay, bye.
Bye.